Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
It's time for another season of The Palmetto Porch, an original podcast from Discover South Carolina. I'm Devin Whitmire. Join me as I get to the heart of what makes South Carolina such a great place to visit by speaking to the locals who make it so special. Premiering December 5th, find The Palmetto Porch wherever you get your podcasts. And for more information about our show, visit scpalmettoporch.com.
Hi, this is your host, Stuart Wright, cutting in to say that my interview with Adam Ray Meyer started without me getting a chance to introduce my guest, as I think we spent about 10 minutes before I cut in with what is the podcast interview. So without further ado, this is my interview with Adam Ray Meyer, writer and director of Dear in America. Well, let's talk about your movie, Dinner in America.
Let's do it.
When and where can people see Dinner in America in the UK?
Arrow. It is streaming on Arrow Player on June 1st.
Fantastic.
And the Blu-ray will be coming shortly thereafter, I think a month or two after. I'm not sure the exact release date, so we'll find that out soon. But, you know, I'm excited for that, too, because this is the type of film for physical media collectors. It plays grindhouse adjacent, and that's been one of the greatest joys, I think, of the film, as far as like festivals and exposure and whatnot, is that it's very nimble. It can do both, you know, kind of prestige art house type of festival thing, or it can play a hardcore genre festival with like, a lot of times we're like the sole comedy in a sea of horror films. And that is super cool because my whole background and my whole love is horror. And, you know, mid to late 70s to mid 80s is my sweet spot right in there. Like everything I love is in that sweet spot.
Well, right, look, there. Let's give people the tease then. Give us a brief synopsis of what Dinner in America is then so people can understand what we're talking about.
Brief synopsis of Dinner in America. Jesus Christ. We had this brilliant brief synopsis that we rattled off like robotically, that we always did like super robotically. So I'm trying to remember what we actually said.
Have the battery's gone on your robot?
Yeah. Well, a lot's happened in the last 15 months. I feel like I've been through the meat grinder and shot back out, you know?
Okay. Well, I'll give the world what I'll repeat what it says on IMDb, and then you can add to it or take away if you think it's missing a beat. But yeah. An on the lam punk rocker and a young woman obsessed with his band unexpectedly fall in love and go on an epic journey together through America's decaying Midwestern suburbs.
I think that's spot on. Now, we had some other thing that we were playing with, but at its core, it's a love story, you know, designed by somebody who's obsessed with genre films. And
I said to a friend of mine after I first watched it, I said it was a nihilistic coming of age story, in a way.
That's great.
Which kind of is an oxymoron, but it's the only way I could describe it, really, is the sense of it was kind of no hope, but also at the same time, there was belief in themselves in a sea of self-loathing, you know?
It's a delayed coming of age story too, you know?
Very much so.
I've thought of it as like, it's a delayed coming of age story because a lot of these things you feel like should be happening like five, six years earlier for Patty, you know, but it's like, she's so sheltered that it's that it's kind of a delayed coming of age story on her end, you know?
Well, look, you wrote and directed this, Adam, and so for you, what was the kernel of the idea that set you off on the road to put a load of index cards and post-it notes all over your wall?
And it's funny because the index cards for some projects and then others are way more freeform.
Go on.
For Dinner in America, we have to travel back in time to 2006.
Okay.
Winter, I'm in Nebraska. And we have to go back a little bit, even before that, to the mid-90s. Mm. I'm in college. In the first couple of years, I went to college in Nebraska at the university. And there were all these flyers all the time posted up for this Harris Labs, where you could go to do these clinical trial studies. Mm-hmm. If, of course, you didn't smoke pot or do drugs or those things. If you had a clean system, you could go and do these clinical trial studies. And I was always like trying to convince my friend, hey, man, maybe we should do one of those studies. Go get like $1,500. You know, all we got to do is sit there for a couple days. It seemed like easy money, but you had no idea what they were really going to do to you in the lab. You know, I'd also a big fan of Strange Behavior or Dead Kids, as it's known. I don't know if you know that film, 82 in there. So you never know what's going to happen in those clinical trials. You could get your mind you get your mind erased in one of them, become a robot or something. So there was a seed, I guess, when I used to see these flyers for this laboratory. Flash forward another decade, and I'm visiting my parents. It's the winter time. There's been some snowfall, and the trucks come through, plowing the snow and shooting out salt and sand to get rid of the ice. I decide to take a walk. And you know that feeling when you're outside and there's snow and it's just dead quiet?
Yeah.
One of my favorite things in the world. So I'm walking in my boots along the side of the road, and the cadence and the rhythm of my boot steps on that sand started to build this rhythm. And I instantly thought of Simon as the character. I thought about him moving through space and time with a cigarette in his mouth. And it was just this, it was this rhythm and the essence of the character in that moment. I ran back, got on, I think it was a manual typewriter. I don't even think it was. I typed it up, the whole first part, the first part of the film, him at the clinical trial studies. He meets a girl, and you think he's going home with the girl. Everything that ends with him throwing the chair through the window and escaping the first house. I wrote all of that in one little burst based on the rhythm and the cadence of my footsteps that conjured up this character smoking a cigarette and moving through space-time. So that was the original seed. I'm glad that you brought up seeds, because I treat my project garden that I have up here, my feature garden on this side, and my TV garden over here. Everything's, you know, you develop seeds and they mature over long periods of time. The maturation periods on the 54 projects on this side over here go from 20 years to 5. There's every 5 to 20 years. Like, no projects that I've developed have had any less time than that. I'm a big, you know, I plant the seed and then I water it and tend to it. And so 2006 for Conjuring Simon, 1996, let's say, for the information about the laboratory. So that thing's just floating around out there for a long time. And then it sticks to this character.
Yeah.
And that becomes a thing. A punk rocker who pays for his recordings, his studio time, by selling his body. That's okay. I've got something there. So I start trying to figure that out, what that looks like. And it was a folder that I had called Kicks. And it was all about this character getting his kicks. You know, he was getting his kicks and he was doing this stuff to make it. And it didn't go anywhere. 2009, I'm writer's block on another project. And I create a folder called Dinner in America. And I just start riffing on this nuclear family, this Midwestern nuclear family. Everything's very vanilla, very beige. You know, the taco seasoning's too hot. The, you know, it's the daughter asks what cumin is. Like, it's just a fucking nightmare. You know, it's this rhythmical nightmare. And everybody's just jabbing at each other. And so I started riffing this family out. And that project was called Dinner in America. It was just an abstract thing. I just started making random scenes with this family. The first of which is the actual scene. The first time you see the family together, like Pat's coughing and, you know, all of that, that initial thing was all written in another.
Have you, out of interest then, have you always been sort of comfortable with that idea of almost like, because it's almost like treating everything like in the abstract until they join up, isn't it? Because I feel like, I'll be honest with you, I think it's took me about the last 10 years to get comfortable with the idea I could just write about, I don't know, an old woman tending a plant and a witnessing something and not know what to do next with it and just park it.
Yeah. I take all of those seeds and I make folders for them and I color them and I, you know, they're all in different, like, they're all very organized and they're arranged. Mm-hmm. And so I plant those things and I just water them. Occasionally I'll drop in 2 years after, I'll write one line and I'll get out and put it away. And so that goes on and on. I've come to accept this, that it, like, everything doesn't have to be all at once, that it really, if you're very patient with things, you'll do it over time and they'll kind of fall in. Also too, it's more fun for me. It's way more fun to be sort of surprised with things sometimes. And so to my point with that, let's see, it's now about 2013.
Right.
So I was doing the Patty kind of seed thing. I had writer's block, was writing something else. Now flash, you know, we're going to shoot forward 4 more years. And I'm dinking around with the Patty thing, the Dinner in America folder. And I think initially I had some boy that was kind of moved in down the street. It was more of a high school type of thing than it was what it ended up becoming. But there's only so many things you can do with young people. There's got to be the opposite sex or there's got to be some type of thing or a relationship of some. It doesn't have to be the opposite sex, but it just needs to be, there has to be something going on in there. And so I think I had it almost like a kind of like a Heather's type of thing.
There was
a new boy, a new student, and Patty was a bit darker, more macabre than she is now. Like, it was a little bit different. So what ended up happening, I thought at some point when I was dinking around with all of this, I was like, what about that character from Kits? What about if you did like a day in the life, and then you combine these two things in a weird way, and then those two people get together. And then it clicked. And I was like, yes, I'll combine the two elements. And now I have something. Now this is, look, it went, we're talking 1996, 2006. It's 15 years later from a Harris Lab flyer that I'm noticing, you know? And it's now a script that I'm going to write, and I'm going to spend another 6 years getting it to get premiered, you know, like it's going to take six more years beyond that. But my point is, those things float in, they float out, they float by. You grab a piece, you know, it's all one thing.
But I think it's constant. Because one of the things I was taught early on was always to write things down. Don't, if you have an idea, write it down, because ideas, if you don't write them down, have a tendency to just poof.
Well, I'm one of those people that actually writes the ideas down when they come to me. Doesn't matter if I'm up in bed and I'll have an idea, I will physically get up, go downstairs, be half asleep and just type it out and come back and look at it in the morning and see if there was something there. But I can't let them go. I can't let something beautiful go when I think of it. I'm just like, oh, I want to do that.
Well, look, I mean, given that genesis and that time period, then as someone that's seen the film and talking to the audience here as much as I'm talking to you, is that the concentration of that idea in the first 10 minutes alone is a phenomena to me. I can't praise you high enough, because in 10 minutes, you manage to satirize paid for pharma research and destroy the nuclear family. And we've barely started. And it was just like, I'm like, where am I going? I don't know, but I'm comfortable not knowing because that's more fun.
And then let's just set up this poor girl for like the shittiest day of her life. Really, it's just like, but it's just par for the course for her day because it's just every day is this thing. She can't even eat a fucking sandwich at a bus stop in private, you know, like have a private moment with a sandwich, just like anything. It's like these two tracksuit wearing guys are just all over her from the second she lets her guard down, you know?
No, the Lord of the Flies aspect of being a young person is it's perfectly portrayed in this movie. It's like you can't even just mosey on by and be yourself without drawing attention. You know, without asking for it, you will draw attention. If you ask for it, you'll get worse attention. So there's a kind of Faustian deal about being just young.
Yeah, yeah, kind of one of the newer projects I'm working on. It feels like a very, you know, like a cousin to this. Hmm. It's another coming of age type of thing that's even more personal to me. And it's funny how, and just how much things have changed. Like as I grew up, like you just walking down the street, people just came and just beat on you real quick. And I mean, just like stuff that probably doesn't happen like that today, like just a different time.
Obviously, punk rock's at the heart of your story, both from the artist and from the fan. What particularly are you drawn on there from a personal point of view, or is it?
Well, I grew up playing in bands and mm-hmm. stuff as a you know teenager. Like when they get to the part in the film where they're in the basement, that's very personal to me. That's like deeply resonating with me there. This was a vehicle by design that I could show a glimpse at that process and what that means to me personally, like the joy of like home recording, because I've been a big home recorder for 30 years. Mm. So I've been doing it for 30 years. And I, you know, part of the process for me, there's an eighth of the page. There's an eighth of a page in the script that's terrifying, you know, which is they perform that Patty sings this song and it's fucking great. Like that's a lot of pressure, right?
Yeah. I know what you mean.
I think it's something like she belted it out and it's fucking amazing. Like, but it's just this little skinny part of a page that doesn't describe it any more than that. And I think for the producers always, you know, they didn't have the reference point that I had. They hadn't spent just thousands and thousands and thousands of hours recording. Like I was a daily recorder for 20 of the 30 years I've been playing. Wow. So daily, every day on my 4-tracker, my 24 track, every day recording. So I have something like 650 audio cassettes of recordings. I've got 3 computers with 180 gigs of songs. And I've spent like serious amounts of time recording. So for me, the thought of recording a song with, you know, my actors, I was so unshaken by that. Or like, there was never a point at which I was like scared. I kept telling the producers, I think ahead of things, you know, initially people probably wanted like, well, what's the song going to be is something that I heard, you know?
Yeah.
And my whole response to that is, well, what's the vessel that it will be emitted from? Because until I have that from a design standpoint, I can't really say. I hate being abstract, but that's also a reality. So it was about casting, you know, Emily, because she's going to be the one that sings the song. Kyle doesn't have a music background, but I was able to work with him in a way like he has some basic knowledge of like, he did another movie where he had to play guitar. So he had like some basic stuff. And I designed something that I knew he could perform on camera with a degree of accuracy, like, because I made it really simple.
Yeah.
And I wanted the song to be something that conceivably these two people would sit down, just like the script says, wow, I can't believe we did all that in 20 minutes, right? It had to reflect what actually could get done in 20 minutes. So, which for me would just be starting with a quick beat, putting the beat down, then putting some bass, some guitar over it, and then turning it over and doing the vocal track on, you know, four tracks. You get four. So that was my general idea. They're just going to lay this stuff down, record it, and do it. And so Emily had been working on, prior to coming out, we had one great thing about the producers was that, not one great thing of a lot of things, but one thing that was really great that they believed in was giving us a 2-week rehearsal period.
Oh, cool.
Prior to the movie, because a lot of times you shoot something and it's just people showing up on night before and then you're doing it. So that said, I didn't use the rehearsal period with Emily and Kyle to rehearse stuff like blocking or do it like reading stuff. We didn't do anything like that. It was about bonding with each other. And the best way for me to do that is with music with people. So the very first thing we did was record all of the PSYOP stuff that Kyle performs. And we brought the band Disco Assault over from across the river in Windsor. And they laid down everything and the scratch tracks and we had worked, I had co-written Dinner in America with them and Kyle laid down all of his vocals and everything. And we did all of that. And the next day we went to a different studio and Emily and I, she had brought all these lyrics as Patty in character, like these love letters to Simon. Yeah. So she came out with all of these like physical pages of stuff. And we're just like sorting through, looking at it. And I saw that line, I'm a watermelon slammed into your driveway. Crack me open so I feel the air inside me. And I was like,
yeah,
that's our jumping off point right there. And so that's, you know, I started riffing something on the guitar. And then she started, now Emily has a background in Broadway. She did a show called Fun Home.
Okay.
And I believe she was nominated for a Tony. So she has pipes. She can do that.
But
for Patty, for the character, it was more important to pull her way back. So it was just like a bird emitting a very pure thing. And that's what, as we sort of sequenced the lyrics and designed it, that's what it became, just this very pure emission.
Yeah,
and,
it felt like for the first time, as it were, singing a song. It had that kind of sense that she was suddenly like this thing that she didn't know was inside her was released, as it were.
Yes. I mean, and it was based on her relationship and this back and, well, not really a back and forth. She had just been sending all of these things to Simon and like using him to pour her heart out to. And now it was a real tangible thing. And he was physically in the same space with her. And it was, I guess, everything was aligned for her to just emit this sound and to do this thing. And that was the most beautiful part of this production.
I bet.
Designing that ahead of time to give the actors that emotional reference point to where we were going so we could pull it back like a slingshot and release it up until that point. They knew where they were going emotionally. Music can do that in a way that nothing else can. So
No. I used to manage a rock band called Tokyo Dragons, who were like a kind of four-piece Thin Lizzy come AC/DC type sound. It was a beautiful... We played with bands like Super Suckers and when they toured Britain and things. And that was a lot of fun. I mean, I haven't got a musical bone in my body, but I like to think I've got good taste.
But you're musical adjacent. So,
yeah, I'm the one that smiles and goes, that's great.
Tastemaking's like incredibly important with music, you know, and having the right people around, you know, to push it.
The runaway story that we watch, one thing that really, really stand out for me, and I think maybe this is me watching it as a writer as much as the audience might, is was your attention to detail in amongst all of the craziness that's going on? Because there's the characters, their evolution as we see them on screen and discover their their opposites and how they attract, almost like a kind of rom-com where it's like, boom, they're friends.
Right.
But there was things you threw at us which were just beautiful little details that gave us just a kind of weird window into the world. So I'm thinking, like, when Simon's on the bus and the old deer sits next to him, or when Simon does his deal in the convenience store and the guy lets him off for free on two cartons of cigarettes. Those kind of things are not story critical by any stretch, but they help with, or they really add value to the experience you're having.
Yeah. Was there a question?
No. Wait. It's just more like, where's put in that kind of, I mean, where are you finding that to add to the story, as it were?
That part is so natural, like, and innate. Like, those are the kinds of things that when I'm out moving through space-time, those are the kinds of things I'm hyper-focused on. When I'm not a broad stroke person when it comes, I'm looking for stuff like that, like interaction like that between people all the time. Just when it's normal and it's not a pandemic and I'm moving free, I love that type of stuff. I love the fact that, like, there's an empty bus and the older gal sits down right next to it, you know, like, just shit like that. I just love stuff like that. So I'm always looking for inspiration for things like that. I pull a lot from interacting with people and just that type of stuff.
It also made us like Simon, though, at the same time, because we've seen this angry man.
Yeah.
And while we've all been there when, you know, I've, you know, the other one would be sitting in an empty cinema and someone sits in front of you, you know, there's the...
I know.
But he doesn't, while you know he's frustrated by it and he's having a bad day, the old deer doesn't suffer for any of his, like, as a sort of byproduct of his impotent rage at that moment in time.
She puts a peppermint in.
It's lovely, isn't it? It's a lovely little move. But equally, the drug deal in the convenience store that concludes with, the guy behind the counter is like, what do I care? And that's kind of, that could be throwaway, but in a way that it gives us a window into a world that we're not party to, the film's giving us.
It was one of the first times, too, that I've ever written with a sort of theme, if you will, how we eat in the country. And with that came a lot of peripheral things of just how we operate in America. And like that guy, he doesn't give a fuck about, it's not his company, it's not his business. What does he give a shit? They're fucking ripping you off anyway. You know, here, just fucking take it. You know, so it's that sort of attitude, how it compounds, what it looks like here. And I think everything was, all of the scene work was almost kind of tethered to, like, even in that scene, he asked him, do you want a hot dog? And here's these hot dogs that aren't covered. They're not even moving. They're just laying there. And he touches one. No, he doesn't want it. He smells his finger. He doesn't want it. It's just this, like, kind of grotesque, all of it's very grotesque and, you know, grotesquely, beautifully American, you know?
Well, yeah, well, that's the thing. I mean, I wanted to move on to the cinematography, because while some of the landscape stuff is obviously beautiful to look at, you're pointing the camera in some really ugly places in terms of backdrops and also fairly ordinary places in terms of convenience stores or the pet store and things like that. But there's a cinematic eye that's lent to them that makes them interesting because we're not seeing them from that point of view usually. So what was your discussions like with Jean-Philippe Bernier? So what was your conversations with your cinematographer about the look and feel you were trying to get? And then how did you see that kind of grungy landscape and think, how can we exploit this?
We had like three different tiers that we would have shot the movie at. I personally had three different designs for the movie. Mm-hmm. So if budgetarily just a little bit lower, then I probably would have done more of a freeform type of thing. Where we landed, JP and I were able to very strategically make the film, and then a slightly higher tier would have been just a little bit different camera design. So I'm very conscious of what I have time-wise, what it's going to take. I've been in physical production for 20 years. I came up through camera and editing. I edited this film. So I was very aware, and being the editor of the film too, I'm able to, like, while we're shooting, I'm able to, like, just rhythmically feel it. When I have it, I'll move on. If I'm like, you know, if I have it, I'm moving on. I'm not going to waste any more time with it. So, the great thing about JP and I was that we had a really beefy, like, 5 or 6 week pre-production phase that we were able to work together.
Oh, fantastic.
So we pre-built and designed the entirety of the movie, like, shot for shot with each other. So we sat in a room, and even if we didn't know all of the locations at the time, we were like, it's a medium, it's going to do this, it's going to move to here. And then we designed the whole film. And we stayed, and that way, when we got on the day, we were able to eliminate any fat that we had. If you know, because it's a production, and there's always some shit that's happening or about to happen, or a light change, a mood change, a weather change. It's Detroit, so a weather change. Like, it's you have to be flexible, and you know, the production should be malleable to all of this too. So, I can't stress enough how flexible you really need to be when you're shooting. You know, I think that's where most people get hung up on this one thing that they want a certain way. And it's like never going to be that thing. I can guarantee you some of those darlings you're going to have to fucking kill for time. Post. So you just have to be really open, always like a tuning fork to things as it shifts, you know?
I really enjoyed a lot of your setup and payoffs, because most of them I didn't see coming, and when they came, I was just like, if I had a hat now, I'd take it off to you. In particular, the first time we see the dead cat on the lawn and where that dead cat ends up in the story is just magical, really, because you hide a big Chekhov's gun in plain sight, and you threaten to use it, and we don't have a clue you're ever gonna do.
I didn't have a clue. That wasn't by design. I had no clue. That cat thing came out of the original sketch with Patty.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a part from the film that we took away where she comes in and she's like, she says to Kevin, he's watching TV, he's eating popcorn after school. And she's like trying to be cool. She's like, did you see the dead cat? And she does an attitude thing. So you see her first day, you see how everybody treats her. And then she goes and takes it out on Kev. And she's like, did you see the dead cat? See all the maggots? And he's like, what maggots? And she's like, you got to flip it. Look underneath. You know, it's like she was a darker kind of Patty thing. I didn't see the cat thing coming. That was always something that was there. It was there with that first dinner. But when I physically started to write the script,
yeah,
I knew at some point that cat was going to come into it. But this was one of the films that I freeformed. So I set up both of those initial intros to the characters were things that I pre-wrote and had many years of time to think about.
Yeah.
But when I sat down and actually combined them, then it was like everything else for me in the writing experience was in real time and new and fresh and linear the whole way. So much so when we got to the arcade, and she, after the arcade shot, and she comes back and she says, I just had the best day ever. And I named the bear, and he's like, what? And she says, Chombi. I had stopped on that. And I think for 3 days, didn't write a single word, stared at my screen, walked around the beach, walked around trying. I couldn't proceed unless I had the perfect name for the bear. Call it a block, call it what you will, but I needed that. I needed this. I needed it to be something good. And Chombi was the ultimate. When I thought of Chombi, it really fit.
Now, Simon's character is, in many senses, is about us finding out the sort of core of his anger, whereas Patty is the one who gets to really grow. I mean, it's not to say that Simon doesn't grow through his experience with Patty, because that'd be untrue, but clearly there's a bigger arc that Patty goes on, and there's a lot more there's a lot more for her to do, I think, as an actor to bring that character to life, because there's so many phases to who she is that we get to see. So that's a long way around of me saying, when you cast Emily Skeggs as Patty and then you start shooting the movie, what is she doing with the Patty character that you couldn't have imagined when you were writing on the page that you're like, yes, this has just gone to the moon. Thank you very much.
To recap what you said, you were saying, what did Emily bring to this?
Well, no, it's more like, what did you, when she starts performing on, you know, the camera's rolling, she's performing and you're now getting the film in the can. What are you seeing in Patty then? It's almost like you write the film, don't you? Then you produce the film, then you edit the film. So you've got the experience of having created this Patty in your mind, and then Patty becomes Emily Skeggs.
What starts with this script, and I've read a lot of scripts. This script is very buoyant, and it's very spiky. It's very, it's like a Warner Brothers cartoon or a Pixies song. It's cold, hot, cold, hot, cold, hot. You know, it's like, it's nice and quiet, then it explodes, and then it's nice and quiet, and it explodes. Like I said, it's very much designed, it feels like, I think you had mentioned it earlier, like they're friends, they're not friends, they're this, it's hot, it's cold. There's a lot of reversals like that constantly. And like you said, there's repeating things that pay off, like these dinners and Simon, and he gets to the end and it's like his fucking prison dinner is better than anything he's had thus far. It's like, so again, there's sort of this theme, but what Emily brought to it was, despite all of that really spiky like movement, she brought this grounded human thing to it that instantly makes her relatable to younger women, older women, like they feel very connected to her, like, yeah. Instant. I feel very connected to her instantly. But, you know, I get from women a lot that she's kind of an every woman, she's an every girl, and everyone really can identify with her because her performance is just very human. Mm. And I love that about it. Like, that's what stands out, and that's what she brought, and that's what, you know, Kyle brings. Like, he's very spiky and very, you know, abrasive, but man, does he fucking sell it when he sees her sing that song. I suddenly feel completely different about him. Mm. And that is a fucking hard thing to do. That is a hard thing to sort of push people away and then yank them back in, you know, to accepting that. So both of them, they brought like so much humanity to the actual characters and what's a very warped and kind of wacky ride. Mm-hmm. And like when they pull out after they've smacked the bullies and all of that, and Patty spit on them, and they pull out of that parking lot and they're screaming, like, I love that. I love that. And that just hits me. And then just the simplicity of, like, she asks, are we going to jail? And he's like, probably. And then you just see her pinky touch his hand. It's like a start. And then later on, again, we pay it off because the next time we see him in the car, they're fully holding hands. Now they're holding hands. So yeah. They've shared a first kiss. And it's just, I don't know. It's Emily just brought so much, like, and also too is, collaborators, they're so warm, so giving. You know, we really became like a little family, you know, when we made it. And I think that that's also super important, having trust with the people that you're working with, and like, you know, really pushing them without physically pushing them. You know what I mean? Like, it's like, I want to push my actors always to do their best. The way I can do that is by articulating things, not by other means. So production becomes more just telepathic, you know, than anything else. And having a good period of on a project, I think that if you haven't met people yet, you haven't worked with them, I think two weeks is more than enough to like start to vibe on each other and you know, sort of share that collective energy for the project. Like, we did not do, there was never a day where we did a read through. There was never a day where we, you know, we didn't do anything like that on this film. It was way more, you know, we recorded music together, now we've recorded and we've got, all have an emotional reference point now. That's on day one and day two. We're, as far as I'm concerned, if I just had those 2 days, I would have been okay, because that exchange was the thing that we rode throughout, that we knew that the crew didn't necessarily know, because our first week was a little rocky. And then we did the song at the end of the second week. The reason the first week was rocky, because we had a bunch of what I would consider bonehead schedule, stuff up front. Like, it was like stuff of them riding in the car and the bus, and just a lot of ugly, hard things. And anytime you're moving a bus or a car with a huge rig on it, it's a lot of work, and it's not a lot of fun work. Like, you're getting that glare on your head right now, right there in your window.
Yeah. The sunshine.
Same type of thing, when you're doing the, all of a sudden everything's been cloudy. And then as soon as you're ready to shoot, the sun fucking breaks through and now it's fucked the whole shot, And so, you got all these guys dinking around with the speed rail and shit on this car. And you're like, I just want to fucking shoot this thing. Like, this is like, 2 hours, 3 hours. You're just like madness, So that part, that's why it's so helpful to, do something where you bond with your cast prior to shooting. So you just sort of have this emotional reference point.
Well, one of the things that I think with the heightened way that the story's told is that you managed to encapsulate in 90 minutes or so what it's like when you haven't escaped small town, because the rules of the world are confined to your experience of the world. And if your experience of the world is of a small town and the people that live in it, so you've got the horrible bullies, you've got the awful boss, and all those kind of things. I mean, while England is a much smaller country than America, we do have small towns. You just happen to be near cities, so it's not hard to escape. I mean, I grew up in a town in North Manchester, which is like 10 miles away from Manchester. But even then, when I was getting to 18, 19, you would have people that you went to school with who would wonder why you would bother going to Manchester 10 miles away. We've got pubs in this town. Why do you want to go to a pub in Manchester? You're like, not that the fact that there's proper gigs going on and there's bands coming from all around the world and things, that never entered their heads. And it's kind of, you realize you were escaping something. And I think that's what, you get that certainly from Patty. I mean, Simon's obviously made that break and meant both men, but only mentally. He's not physically done it, because part of it is he's tied. He seems tied to the place as much as he's trying to break free, which is a kind of interesting choice to make there, that he's not from out of town. He's from there as much as Patty is.
And he realizes in a weird way that it's all very fleeting and that this isn't something that is going to be sustainable, to be some kind of rocker. So I don't know what it looks like for him, because it feels like he's already making those choices where, whether he's a self-sabotager and he doesn't actually want success or wants to push that, he seems to push the guys in his band away from the idea of doing what he views as like a commercial kind of tour with this band that he thinks is less than they are, but they've achieved some little bit more of success, the Alliance. They're ready to sign up and go on this tour if the band likes them, and Simon's just like, fuck this shit, guys are posers,
the voice of 100 bands when Bad Religion and The Offspring got major label deals.
Right? Yeah. I remember.
It was a bit, and it is interesting part of the idea of growing up, because growing up means you've got to take responsibility, and taking responsibility means earning money. And obviously being in a punk rock band is the least responsible thing you can do, in a way.
I think he's a purist. I think he's a music purist and an audiophile. Like, and I think that for him, there's a lot of meaning in that. And I guess when you're building any character, as long as that means something to them, you're on the right path for that character,
Well, look, two films that really resonated out of your film for me watching it that made me think as reference points for people listening would be, the obvious one, because of the punk content, would be Green Room. And while it's a different slant of what it's like to be in a band, I think you definitely, obviously with your own experience you've described, that idea of recording at home, getting your own stuff, flyers, band relationships. I mean, that was a fairly true representation, I thought. The idea of they all look to him and he abuses them all, yet they all look to him and he abuses them all. So it's kind of it's like they hate to love him and love to hate him. It's sort of a and that's just normal in bands for reasons that, you know, everyone's an imposter until they succeed, I suppose. But equally, but the bigger sort of comparison I'd make would be God Bless America, which has got a similar kind of disdain, I guess, for a modern America. While at the same time saying isn't it great that we're free to do what we want at the same time. It's a kind of weird, it's a weird oxymoron, isn't it? That
I think the film lives in that space, you know, like being simultaneously critical and accepting too. I mean, of it, of America, I suppose. I think observationally, I'm drawn to like a lot of that, you know, what I think is just the injustices, or just like, just observationally, like just, I guess negative aspects, like whether in this film in particular, just food and our relationship to it abstractly, like whether it's Connie and the frozen cordon bleu that Kev points out, you know, that it's not like she made it herself. It's frozen, you know, like he has to be a little butthead and say that type of stuff. But, you know, Simon kind of quick to throw his experiences, his fake experiences in Tanzania, you know, at Kev and sell him on the idea, well, you have it pretty good here, you know, and eventually we find out not only do you have it pretty good here of how you're eating, you have it pretty good here for an adopted kid, you know, so you should just shut your mouth and hang out with your guinea pigs, you know, so.
Well, I read today, funny enough, that a family that eats together with the television off is the healthiest family.
Yeah.
And it's, I mean, you had the two contrasts with the two families. As much as Patty's family was dysfunctional in the sense of they kept a secret from their son, they weren't an unpleasant family in the same sense as the first family we meet, where it's, you know, the kind of the father, son, the woman self-medicating on wine.
And the, you know, the mom's wasted and they've got a spread
to feed an army.
Like for 15 people, but you know they're going to throw away most of it. They're just going to throw it away. So it's that sort of excess, what Sunday dinner looks like for this family, and if that's a status thing for them, I'm not sure, you know. But then you've got Norm and Connie and their whole, you know, kind of Midwestern frozen cordon blues and, you know, taco salad night. You know, there's a reference point to New England clam chowder for Thursday night that sets Simon off. You know, he's like, Jesus fucking Christ, you know.
But I guess these are all signs, aren't they, and signals of that you've stopped discovering, you've settled. I mean, and it's a frightening thing when you're young, looking at when you settle down. I mean, I'm a man of fast approaching 50, and to me, you know, the idea of sleeping rough and getting to a gig is a ridiculous idea. Whereas in my 20s, I slept on floors and used my shoes as a pillow. You know, it's like
no brainer. You know, So it's and Simon's hovering in the sweet spot there of like he's about to figure that out. We know some of the audience knows that he's about to figure that out. He's almost vaguely aware of it too. That it's all very fleeting, and you know, so I like the little snow globe that this thing lives in.
It lives in
a little. When you're asking about, you know, time period and when it's set, you know, it's like, or maybe you weren't asking about time period, but people do ask about time period, and it's like, it's just sort of timeless. It just is sort of a thing, you know.
I was going to ask you that, but I thought better against it because I like the idea that it's non-specific. I get the impression it's trying to hold off on technology, so therefore it makes me think it's of a different time.
I'm bored with seeing it's contemporary. It is.
Well, the buses made me think it was contemporary because they're immaculate.
And well, Simon even says himself, "You don't want to play to a sea of cell phones."
That's when the penny dropped. Yeah,
when we go to this other screening in this other, or sorry, we go to this other show, there's no one with cell phones pointed at the thing. So we're obviously, Simon likes the energy of having a crowd around him and being, you know, the feeding off of that type of thing. So I think that just in general, I'm so bored and so over looking at people in the movies, text people, I could just fucking care less. So if I can design it where they pick up a landline and they talk on it, because let's face it, like, old phones are fucking way sexier to look at than cell phones.
They you can see them for starters.
Yeah. One thing I did go for though was the hideousness of those shoes that the fucking track boys wear, those white puffy shoes. I fucking loved that. I was like, these are the worst looking shoes I've ever seen in my life. They're just an abomination. If you get a chance to look at them again, when the one has his leg over the other one's shoulder and it does the quick zoom into it.
Right.
Just look at that hideous white puffy shoe. It's just the worst design I've ever seen for a shoe.
Well, let's remind people then, when and how can they see Dinner in America?
It's going to be streaming on Arrow Player on June 1st. So just a month shy of America's birthday. So, you know.
What a way to celebrate.
What a way to celebrate, yeah.
Well, look, it just gives me to say thank you very much for giving your time on the BritFlix podcast.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.